and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Along with me, as always, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hey there.
I'm going to do another quick movie review.
Okay.
Because I went out and I saw No Time to Die, the new James Bond movie.
I was slowly dying inside. I was up in St. Cloud all weekend and not able to see it. So don't spoil anything for me.
Oh, no. I'm just going to say this. Mm-hmm. This movie services James Bond fans. Okay. You know, I will say that through the service of the first four movies, mm-hmm. Daniel Craig has made this more of a Jason Bourne series. And I don't mean that in a bad way.
Okay.
It is just the sense that, you know, he was a lot more serious. You didn't get the campy one-liners. You didn't get some of those essential James Bond moments that have been in every James Bond movie. Mm-hmm. And he kind of gives that back to the audience this time. It's not like he's throwing out campy one-liners throughout the whole movie, you know, but he gives a taste of the old James Bond throughout his storytelling in this one. So I really enjoyed it. I think it's going to be a polarizing movie, but I'm going to say this. The biggest problem I had with Spectre,
okay,
was that I really like, and his name just totally slipped my mind, the actor who played Blofeld.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Why can't I not remember? Anyway, he's, you know, what I didn't care for was the fact that they came off Skyfall, which was such a powerful movie and was kind of this weird mommy revenge story, right? With another fallen agent and James Bond and both vying for the attention of M. So it was this kind of weird mommy thing. And then the second one becomes like a daddy thing. And what I didn't like was that Blofeld, throughout the entire movie, his voice never changes. He always sounds like Brain from Pinky and the Brain cartoon to me. There's no real emoting. It's a weak story and premise. To me, that's what Rami Malek brings to this. He is another monotone villain who speaks like this throughout the entire movie, showing very little emotion. He's inconsequential. You literally could have put a monkey with a ray gun in that role, Tim.
Okay.
And I don't mean that in a bad way. Mm-hmm. It's just that they didn't give him something. He wasn't a fully realized villain. They gave him a backstory. They gave him but it was like they just. What was cool was the plot, the driving force of what he wanted to do, and the device in which to do it. That's cool. That's scary. That's crazy. It could have been any villain. And it would have been a great plot device.
Christoph Waltz.
Yeah, that's it. And I, like I said, I really like him. And I know he's a more laid back kind of, I've always felt that Daniel Craig's James Bond has always been, I don't need to be a man of words. I'm a man of action. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the old saying that usually it's the ones that talk the most and bluster the most are the weakest. Mm-hmm. Right. I don't know if they were trying to go for that with Blofeld and with Rami Malek's Safin character or what, but there wasn't any meat to the character for me. But there's some great oohs and ahs. There's some great moments in the movie that really pay homage to the entire James Bond series on the whole, and an action right out of the chute. So I liked it. I'm glad I saw it. I'm glad, and I will miss Daniel Craig as James Bond. So we'll just have to see how the future goes. But I would say I would give it a solid 4.5 out of 5 stars.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, well, Dave, what does it have to do with true crime? Well, obviously there's a villain involved, people, and he's trying to do something horrible to the people of planet Earth. So there's your tie. Jeez, you people. Stupid questions, Tim. What's it got to do with true crime?
I always
got
to spoon feed people. Yep.
I know. No, that's it. So that's it. I was just very excited. You know, I'm a huge Bond fan, and I literally got done filming on Friday night, 20 minutes before the first showing of it. Mm-hmm. And I like flew over there, got in, sat down in the movie theater, and just let myself be absorbed for, you know, and it's a long movie. I think it's almost 3 hours.
Wow.
But it doesn't feel like it. You buzz through and there's so much going on. Even my dad, mm-hmm. he's not a guy that likes to sit in the theater for more than 2 hours.
Yep.
And he's like, man, didn't feel like anything over an hour and a half, 2 hours. It just engages you, and it's a moving train the entire time.
That's good.
So, yeah. So that's cool. That's good. We got an interesting guest coming up. For those of you that are subscribers to our premium Stitcher, you stay tuned after the interview and you'll get to hear Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals. For those of you that are listening through the standard Darkness Radio feature with commercials, you get the entire interview on today's program. Today, Monster, The Life and Crimes of Wayne Chapman. Our guest is David McGrath. David, thank you so much for joining us and spending some time here today.
Oh, thank you, guys. Great opening monologue as usual, and I'm grateful to be here. Thank you.
Well, it's a pleasure, and I appreciate this. Tim, as a listener and friend of our show, actually authoring a book and then approaching me to be on the show is awesome. So I thought I'd let you know that aspect of our guest, Tim. So he's a listener and longtime supporter of our program, so we appreciate that.
That's awesome.
Yeah. All right. So, David, you're a forensic investigator working on becoming a criminologist, right? What drew you to this specific story and Wayne Chapman?
I guess it would have started sometime in my young adult life. My father was essentially out of the picture for a good portion of my life. And, just frankly, I was a victim of childhood sexual abuse by somebody who was close to my family. And I had really stuffed down a lot of that pain and shame for a lot of my life. You know, it wasn't until I was until I met my wife and started having my own kids long after my long military career that, I started to sort of comprehend what all had happened to me, you know, and how to sort of deal with that in a healthy manner. So I came from I identified with victims more than anything. And I wanted to, I'd always been a writer. I had written for my high school newspaper. I had written, God, David, I've probably written for I think the first online outlet that ever published anything that I wrote was the Drudge Report. That's how far back I go.
Okay.
It was around 99, 2000 when I was 16 or 17 years old. And then at 17, after 9/11, I went into the military and I sort of pushed all that pain away for, a decade and a half while I worked on times in Iraq and Afghanistan. And when I got done and I sort of got out, around 2013, I started to think about what I was going to do with the rest of my life, I had a hard time transitioning. I had a hard time having relationships, sort of all that pain and trauma from my childhood was still very much there. I'll never forget. It was a night in 2013 where my son, who's now 7, my wife was pregnant with my son, and I had a head cold. I was up late, and I saw a documentary on HBO by a woman named Melanie Perkins called Have You Seen Andy? And, she was a childhood friend of a young boy who went missing in Lawrence, Massachusetts, about 20 minutes from where I grew up in Boston. And she made a documentary about the little boy that was, she grew up with her in the projects there in Lawrence in the mid 70s. And it was sort of a snapshot of the time period. It was a basic overview of all the facts around Andy's disappearance. And sort of at the end of the documentary, there was, a good bit on the main suspect in Andy's disappearance, who was a sex offender from Jamestown, New York, a man named Wayne Chapman. And she sort of alluded to the fact that there were five other sex offenders present at the pool the day that Andy went missing. And towards the end of the documentary, there is a picture.
Wait a minute. Predators?
Five. Yep.
Yikes. All right.
And as I get into in the book in horrifying detail, these men all work together, but once I saw Chapman's booking photo in his eyes, as a kid, I was a huge fan of Donald Pleasance and Halloween. He would talk about Michael Myers and his sort of cold, vacant eyes. And the picture of Chapman stuck with me that entire night. In fact, I remember, I'd always wanted to do a book. I was writing for a lot of different outlets, like I said at the time. And I remember my editor was doing a book at one website, and we had talked about it, and he was like, you know, it's a hard slog, but if you really think you know, that's something you want to do. And again, Dave, you know, I grew up on books. I grew up in the library as a kid, you know, to this day at 37 years old, I'm still 2-3 books a week. And it sort of buoyed me to take on this project. And, you know, once I woke up, got up the next morning, I Googled Wayne Chapman's picture again. And I actually kept that on my desktop for years because I never wanted to forget. And I needed to know everything there was to know about this man. I just knew that there was something more that this 10-year-old boy encountered that day at the pool. And I knew that this was a much bigger story than just one missing child on one random day in a city not far from Boston. And I needed to know every last detail about it or die trying.
So this literally became an obsession for you.
Yeah, I mean, here we are in 2021 and the book's going to be released in 2 days. For about 3 years, Dave, I researched it. I traveled to every spot that was important in Chapman's life. I talked to people who knew him, you know, in Sunday school in the 1960s. And I shelved it after about 3 years, Dave. And I think the reason why I did it is because the subject matter was just putting me in such a dark place. I mean, who wants to, you know?
Yeah, I can understand that. Especially when you're looking at children involved in these kind of crimes and somebody who literally is just a monster, who just moves from one offense to another and really, you know, moves through it like a shark, right? I mean, that has to be kind of deflating as you read and research about this man and what he does and who he is, that there's no empathy, no remorse. There's nothing to a human being like this.
Yeah, I just, it's true. And I'm sure we'll talk about later. My face-to-face meeting with Chapman is I detail in the book, but you know, throughout the beginning parts of the research. So, you know, the years 2014, 2015, and say 2016, you know, I thought that I had the book written and ready to publish 5 or 6 different times, David. And just every time I thought I had it done, I would get an email or a phone call from someone else saying, you think you know, but you actually are missing this. And I grew up in that era and I know this. And then I would have to corroborate a whole bunch of new facts that I didn't think I could leave out. And, you know, and there were times when the subject matter would just depress me so much and push me so far down the hole that I would just stop altogether and put it away for months. And then something else would buoy me and I'd pick it up again and go. And also, Dave, you know, I took really no artistic license in this book. I wanted to make sure that it was a clear, factual understanding, not just of Wayne Chapman and his crimes, but really a snapshot of what the 1970s was like in the New England area and some other surrounding states.
But why don't you start us off with that? Give us kind of a feel in that era. What was it like there? What were the times like, the people?
Well, for starters, the whole, you know, and I talk about this a lot in the book, is the whole stranger danger thing was just, well, it was not a thing at the time. Kids are so much more educated nowadays, you know, than they were obviously in the 1970s. I mean, you know, I mean, I obviously was born in the mid-80s, but I'm sure you know, you ate your breakfast and you left the house on your bicycle and you came back for lunch and then you were back for dinner. And what you did in between those times, there wasn't any real fear because we didn't have the data that we have now of just how much danger children are in around certain members of our society. And statistically speaking, and I think this is the real most important point of the book, is that Wayne Chapman lives in someone's community right now. And that's just the truth. But in the pre-internet, these pedophiles, especially in this area that this book focuses on, they would meet at public parks. They would meet at schools. They would take pictures of children from a distance, and parents had no idea what was going on. A lot of the backup of most of these crimes is that they were sort of involved in a crude sort of new early ring of child pornography. They would victimize these kids and take lots of pictures of them during it, trade them. It would be sold in the back of CD sex shops in Boston and surrounding areas, all unbeknownst to law enforcement and parents. I mean, the snapshot of the time that I was really able to gather from talking to hundreds of people who lived in the neighborhoods at that time is that they always felt like they were being watched. Adults would just come up to them, offer them jobs, ask them to look for lost dogs, try to lure them away from their friends and into the woods. David, I've been told this story hundreds of times.
Right.
And it was always one of four or five people. The descriptions, the modus of operation, the vehicles that they drove. I mean, these guys who worked together, Chapman included, were incredibly prolific in this area in the 1970s.
All right. Well, let's find out about this monster himself. What's the earliest information you could dig up on him and what his life was like?
You know, I talk a lot about this in my criminology studies. The general rule of thumb, I feel like, from people is that men with pedophilic tendencies are nurtured that way through abuse. Maybe they were sexually abused themselves. And while that I do see that quite often, in my experience, Dave, these men are born. Wayne Chapman was 100% born a pedophile. I was born a straight male. You can't tell me tomorrow that I could be, you know, I could just become gay through therapy or something like that. I was born this way. It's in my DNA.
Right.
Wayne Chapman was quite the same. I mean, he came out. Now, I did find instances of abuse, you know, not more than any child who probably grew up in the 1940s from a, you know, or was born in the 1940s, grew up in the 1950s to a father who was actually a war hero. Wayne Chapman's father had been injured at Guadalcanal, was a respected member of the community in Jamestown, New York, where Wayne was born and raised. He was part of the local neighborhood watch. He was a very active member of the church. Wayne Chapman's father was beloved in the community. His mother was a well-liked woman. She was a stay-at-home mom, very loving. Wayne himself has stated on the record many times that his house was relatively normal for the times. His father was a little cruel to him, especially during bedwetting incidents, things like that. But nothing that I could find that I would see, you know, deemed to be, you know, excessive abuse against the young man. No sexual abuse at all. Even through the Wayne had three younger brothers. None of them ever claimed any abuse. He came from a normal household for the time period. Wayne himself started offending around 6 or 7 years old, and it started with the molestation of his younger brothers. He would make his younger brothers undress, and I don't want to get too graphic for your audience, but he sexually assaulted his younger brothers. He was arrested 4 times before the age of 18 for corrupting the morals of minors. He was totally fixated from a young age on young boys. His uncle, Willard, found his behavior to be strange, and his father.
I think everybody would have found his behavior. You know what's really telling to me, and I don't mean to take you off track here for a minute, sure, but it's interesting for a kid that didn't deal with that abuse at such an early age. What synapse in his brain was triggered that he was sexualizing others? That there was, because until you know how that feels, why would you be driven to do it? Do you know what I mean? I mean, if a kid is molested, you could almost say, all right, I understand they're acting out, lashing out, trying to victimize somebody else because they felt like they were oppressed. You know, or getting that sensation because they liked that. But at that age, how would he have even known about any of that sexual gratification? That's a really bizarre aspect to me, right? I mean, violence is violence. We grow up watching it on TV. Every Bugs Bunny cartoon, every, you know, cartoon that we ever watched was violence, and video games and whatever. You get that. You get that people are entrenched in that, and maybe it elicits an emotion. But the sexual gratification and abuse for somebody that has no background in it, God, God, that is something that just I don't understand where that trigger comes from.
Well, David, I think it's a dual thing. A, he was born a pedophile, so there was no way to change that. Wayne Chapman was always going to be attracted to young boys. He was born homosexual and he was born a pedophile. He's one of the rare pedophiles, though, where he just had no ability to care about victims. You know, I will run into cases all the time in my case studies where the pedophiles will be almost virtuous. You know I have this attraction to young boys or young children, and I'll never act on it because I don't want to destroy somebody's life. Wayne Chapman was exactly the opposite. He was a psychopathic pedophile. He would do whatever it took to get sexual gratification. The only thing he thought about in life was abusing young boys. There was nothing else. He didn't fish. He didn't go to baseball games. He didn't care about sports. All he cared about was stalking, luring young boys away from their friends, isolating them, and then sexually abusing them for his own gratification. And he was born that way. And there would have been no way to stop it other than lock him away from polite society at a young age.
Right. But at what age did he start doing these abusive things?
7 years old.
So I get that you're born homosexual. That's fine. I get that. But the predatorial aspect and not having had sex or having had abuse prior to this, it's like, I guess maybe because we're all Hollywoodized, we want to believe there's a trigger moment. There's that time the priest or the teacher or the nun or the cop or, you know, the creepy neighbor or weird Uncle Larry touched you in an inappropriate way that awoken something, and you're trying to get back that power. But at seven, to be gay is one thing. Kids don't really, you know, listen, I'm a father of 11 kids. Wow. They don't know their sexuality for a long time, right?
Sure.
If I had to put money on two or three of my boys having been gay when they were young, I would have thought, oh, this is a no-brainer. And they're not. They're raging heterosexuals. They just had very effeminate actions and interests and things that, you know, at that point. And before you start the hate mail, folks, this is coming from a guy who just wasn't used to a kid being more interested in interior decoration than sports. And, you know, you generalize people and things. So, but you really, kids just don't, you know, they're at that age. That's the furthest thing from their mind. They're not worried about this, that, or the other. They're worried about, you know, getting dirty, going out and playing, watching movies, whatever, you know, cartoons, not seeking somebody to abuse. So this kid was literally born brain damaged. It has to be. There was just some chemical off. And again, the paranormal side of me wants to say, is this a remnant of who he was in a past life? Because we know that a lot of kids that are reincarnated seem to keep a portion of those memories and thoughts and who they were from a past life until the age of 7 or 8. So that would be an awakening. That might be his intro. But again, I feel like I'm giving too convenient an out to just somebody who is broken. And maybe there doesn't have to be a genesis point. It's just some people are born evil.
I'm so glad that you mentioned the paranormal aspect, because his parents did. I was able to corroborate that they did in fact think about bringing him to the church and potential exorcism at a very young age. His uncle had caught on to his behavior and went to Arthur, his father, and said, hey, listen, you know, we got to do something about this kid. Arthur was very old school. He thought maybe, you know, he'd grow out of it. Maybe enlisting, you know, in the military when he got older would straighten him out. Willard brought him to a psychologist in town, and the psychologist was so unnerved by Wayne's vacantness, just the, even at 7 years old, just how freely he talked about his sexual predilections and what he had done to his brothers and what he thought about doing to kids in his own class, which I'm sure we'll get into, that, you know, the doctor in Jamestown basically just said, you know, this kid needs Jesus, he needs an exorcist, and he needs to be locked away from polite society, and he needs at the very least intense psychotherapy. And we're talking about a boy who couldn't even tie his own shoes yet, and this is what the doctor's talking about. I mean, I have a boy that age right now. I mean, the only thing he cares about on earth is YouTube, you know what I mean? So it's really hard to make sense of. I agree. And just going back to that genesis point, Wayne Chapman does tell a story about he was 4 or 5 years old and some girls cornered him at school. I could never corroborate it. And frankly, you know, David, I don't know if I believe it because Chapman lied so much in his later life that they cornered him, made him disrobe. And that's what got him thinking down the track of sexuality. And I'm quoting him. So maybe there's a little bit of it there, but I'm really of the mind that this man was just born broken.
God, horrific. And that the family kind of clued in on this early and were showing concern. At least that's a good sign, right? I mean, it wasn't like they were completely oblivious to this. But do you believe that there was still aspects of just kind of sweeping it under the carpet, trying not to face it?
His father was a long distance truck driver. He was out of town sometimes 27 days out of the month, making a living for the family. He had 3 younger brothers that came along. His mother always looked at him as the favorite. She doted over him, firstborn son. I have a firstborn son. I know how that feels. It is hard to sometimes, you always look at that child in a positive light, at least I do. And his mom was a lot of the time enabling and making excuses for his behavior, even all the way up to his later crimes, which were absolutely unspeakable. But the brothers were clued into it very early. In fact, Dave, all of them died of alcoholism. They all became major alcoholics. We'll never know what exactly triggered that, but they all died young. Wayne's still alive at the ripe old age of 73.
Well, we could probably figure out what triggered it.
Right.
That
exactly.
Doesn't take rocket science, right? But yeah, I get your point.
The brothers basically never showed up to any of his court hearings. They completely disowned Wayne for 5-6 decades before they died. So that'll clue you into just, he had nobody left at the end.
Okay, so we're getting a taste of just what kind of kid he was. And how long does this abuse ever take a hiatus? Does it ever stop for him? Or is it just, you know, like a shark just steadily moving through the water looking for the next victim?
That's such a great question. In November of 65, he was 17 years old. Wayne lured a boy into the woods and assaulted him sexually. And that was his first taste of the criminal justice system as, you know, nearly an adult. He ended up getting $100 cash bail. He was released that night. The entire community was embarrassed. His parents were embarrassed because it happened right there in Jamestown, only 6 blocks from where he lived. It was a local boy that, as I go into in the book, he stalked for a very long time. He would watch him at school. He would take pictures of him at the park. Blonde hair, blue eyed boy, which was Wayne's ideal victim. After that 1965 conviction, where he ended up having to go to psychiatric counseling and didn't see the inside of a prison outside of that first day, I really couldn't account for his behavior or his whereabouts or his connections, Dave, for 66 and some of 67. My basic rule of thumb with Wayne Chapman is if he's breathing, if he's mobile and living, he's offending. He never admitted to any more victims during that small time period, but Wayne Chapman essentially went dormant for about 15, 16 months. I was able to corroborate the fact that, you know, he was a member of the underground sort of pornography rings in Jamestown and upstate New York. He spent a lot of time in different porn shops, would find the child pornography sort of in the back room, secret handshake kind of thing. But offenses against children in that time frame from about late 65 to early 67, that was the only time I could find where Wayne Chapman wasn't committing crimes that I could get on paper and actually get some factual evidence behind it.
So there might have been a respite for him, but when does it seem to come back alive then? Is it around 67, 68?
So he commits the crime in Jamestown and realizes that even though Chapman was not a smart man, his IQ was around 65 to 80 during all the tests that he'd taken. He failed first grade. He failed kindergarten. He had to be held back in both. He was borderline Mendoza line level of smarts, but he was smart enough to know that he couldn't commit crimes in Jamestown anymore. His parents had too much embarrassment. His father threw him out of the house right after it. He had to go live with his grandmother. School, he never graduated. He essentially left school a senior year after the corruption charge on the 10-year-old boy that we just spoke about. So Chapman realizes now that the heat's on. It's a small town. Local law enforcement is watching him all the time. He opined many times that he couldn't hang out at the parks anymore. He couldn't chase children around in schoolyards anymore. All of that was basically taken away from him. But at this point in his life...
Wait, who is he opining to about this?
I would get it later from psychological documents and friends of his from the time period. He would opine to them that he basically was being harassed by police, because at that time, Dave, I mean, there wasn't a lot of people running around. You know, there wasn't a lot of sex offenders to keep an eye on. You know, there wasn't like a registry or a list or anything like that. He was the only one there, you know,
and he was pretty high profile at that point.
When you have somebody who his parents are stalwarts of the community, they're, you know, Wayne had just been awarded not even a month before the crime. And this is an important detail. The Youth of the Year award from his local church for his great community involvement and dedication to Christianity. That's how, and he was second page on the Jamestown Journal newspaper. I mean, he was a well-known member of the community. He carried old ladies' groceries. He held doors. He was a respected member, along with his father and mother and his brothers, of the
small. He was a sociopath then who could blend, or not attempted
a smart man, but not a smart guy, but definitely able to adapt to any situation to make you feel he could manipulate quite well.
All right. Boy, that's just, you know, it's tragic, especially as you're digging into this and uncovering more and more aspects of each story. That's got to be heartbreaking to realize, man, look how many times they had him. Look how many times this could have stopped. And he just really kind of went unimpeded.
Yeah. And horrifyingly enough, Dave, he would go mobile soon with no real family backup. You know, they had all basically just exiled him. He had a vehicle, and in June of 1967, he ends up in Oil City, Pennsylvania. He knows now he cannot commit crimes close to home. The heat is on his family. He's embarrassed everybody. So now he's starting to understand that the first time around it went sideways on him because the boy fought back. He didn't gain his trust, and this time he starts to build his elaborate ruses, which would really become the hallmark of all of Wayne Chapman's crimes for the rest of his life until his incarceration in his late 20s. He meets a boy in Oil City. He's down stalking parks 58 miles from home. He thinks he's safe. And he meets a young boy who starts telling him that he is trying to make money to save for a car. He wants to buy baseball cards. He's interested in all these different things. And this is right from some of the police reports and some police who were actually on ground that day who I was able to talk to, luckily enough. Wayne Chapman tells the boy, okay, tomorrow meet me here and I'll get you a job as a paper boy. You know, he gives him an elaborate ruse. His father owns this, you know, company that can help him out, which is another thing he always kind of does with young boys. The next day, the boy shows up after Wayne, again, at 18 years old. And I sort of paint this scene in the book. You know, most kids that he went to high school with were maybe, you know, drafted into Vietnam, serving in the military. They were going to college. They had girlfriends. Wayne Chapman is sleeping in his van with no air conditioning overnight in front of the woods, sweating through his shirt so he can be on time to meet a 12-year-old boy to lure him into the woods so he can sexually assault him. That's where he was at that time in his life. And he was becoming more bold. The boy ends up showing up. Chapman brings him to the woods. The boy tries to run. Chapman gives him a brutal beating. The boy presses him about where the job is. Chapman just keeps asking him pointed sexual questions. And eventually the boy comes hip to the point that he's not there for any kind of job and that he's in serious danger. He ends up getting away, but Chapman choked him, stuffed his shirt down his throat, gagged him, nearly suffocated him to death, but did not get to the point where he could sexually assault him, thank God. In fact, the young man who he did that to would often state that the taste of the fabric in his mouth from his shirt would haunt him for the rest of his life. I mean, Chapman was already irrevocably shattering lives, and this was And that's nothing compared to what he ended up doing when he got down into New England later. But this boy was able to escape the woods, scream to some adults, and Chapman got lost getting out of the forest. He was so fixated on the young boy that he didn't remember his way out. And by the time he got to his van, the police were there to get him. And he made no bones about what he was doing. This was not a master criminal. This is a man who would offend in broad daylight. So he admitted to the police, and he ended up getting a 1 to 2 year sentence, to which he served a year of.
So something that heinous, he only gets a year after he has been arrested for similar crimes in the past. To what end does law enforcement deem that that was a good plan?
You know, again, from David, you know, I have talked to everybody involved in this case who was still alive and had some clear recollection of what happened. A lot of people I've talked to have told me that the people in charge, their bosses, the sergeants and the lieutenants, just didn't look at sexual assault. I mean, I had one detective tell me that he had been trailing Wayne Chapman for months, and I'm sure we'll get into it, digging through his trash, never letting him out of his sight. And his boss basically told him, I need you to chase down car thieves, like get off the Chapman thing. I just don't think we understood during that time period just what a danger a man like Wayne Chapman posed to the community.
Was the concept of that kind of sexual abuse at that time just not a big issue in law enforcement, do you feel? Was there something, you know, and I don't mean to make it sound dismissive, but it, you know, if it was between adults, maybe I could understand them at that point in our twisted history. Just, you know, that was of course of at the time when it was, well, look at the way she was dressed. She kind of asked for this. And, you know, that was kind of the mentality. But with children involved, you would think that there would be some different aspect to it. And it would be handled more criminally. It would be handled in a way that these guys wouldn't be so readily available back out there.
Yep. I say this in the introduction of the book, if you are looking for a happy ending in this story, this is not the book for you. This book will make you angry. There is nothing about this book that is redeeming. And I agree with you 100%. And Chapman continued to offend and continued to get out. And, you know, to point to one thing in the 1960s, I will point to the fact that, you know, we were much more liberal on things like sex. And I just don't think there was anybody there at the time qualified enough to point out the trajectory that Wayne Chapman was on.
God, you know, and you're right. I guess from a distance and with time, you can look back at this and see all the internal flaws to the thinking and the concepts of the time, but not being as aware of just how bad these things were. And maybe at that time, I'm sure the neural net was not as strong in keeping up with a person's past. So they may not have even been as aware of the type of things he was doing and where he was doing them.
Right. I mean, just think about it. You would probably not even be able to find any of his crimes in Jamestown by doing a search of his name when you're the responding officer at the time. And that's a very common theme in the book, is that Wayne Chapman offended in so many states that sometimes states would not even talk to each other. Somebody in Providence, Rhode Island, didn't know what Wayne Chapman had admitted to doing in Virginia or Pennsylvania or Ohio or Maine. So he was so prolific and so mobile that it was really kind of, you know, it was tough for the detectives to get a real handle on the amount of victims that Chapman really had.
Okay, well, this is just the 60s and 70s for this guy. Is he just, and in this, and, you know, I don't mean it to sound dismissive because it's horrific that he's treating people like this, but is it like a pretty ongoing situation? Does he go from one stalking method to another? Is he constantly looking for the next victim?
Yeah, I mean, he was, again, if he was breathing, he was stalking victims. I mean, he goes to jail. He does the 1 year in jail after this assault. He's placed on probation. And, you know, prison is not kind to him. as you would imagine, even in those days, you know, prisons have hierarchies and sex offenders and especially people who hurt children, you know, they're somewhere down there with like, you know, scum on the bathroom floor, you know, so it was not good to him. You would think that if he had the ability to curb some of these feelings that he would do that, but he's released from prison and with not even 3 months later, he's back in Pennsylvania, a little bit farther away from Oil City in a different part of the state. And he's offending again on in broad daylight. And this time he actually finishes the assault and has his way with another boy. So in broad daylight in the middle of the afternoon at 12:30 on a Saturday. So Chapman could not stop himself.
Is he considering at any of these points that, you know, maybe the best method is, you know, do what I want, then murder them so there is no chance of them running around telling the story and ratting him out?
He had confessed many, many times in interviews, you know, during his incarceration that it often crossed his mind that he should just murder the boys to keep them quiet. But for whatever reason, he just never does it until he gets to Angie Puglisi. The boys fight back. They get away.
We'll get to that point in a minute. Yeah, I don't want to give too much away as we continue to take the story forward. The book, we'll have a link for it, folks. And you can just go to darknessradio.com, click on the storefront, and we do put all of the books that are available and links to them in our True Crime Tuesday section, paranormal books in the paranormal section, and so on. So you can go visit for that. We'll be back. We've got more to discuss with our guest right after this. The book, Monster, The Life and Crimes of Wayne Chapman, our guest, David McGrath. He has spent the better part of, 6 years invested and investigating into this case. Is that correct? 6 years?
I am on my, Dave, I guess this would be technically the 7.5 now that I've, and the book is, for me, it was kind of cathartic. Like, okay, it's on paper, it's all edited, it's readable, it's digestible. I am washing my hands of Wayne Chapman. That's at least what I tell myself anyway.
Okay, so take us through this. And I'm curious, do you ever go back and look in the areas that he was? Were there any other missing boys that fell into that age range, blonde, blue-eyed, that look that did go missing that never resurfaced? And was Chapman ever considered part of those crimes?
Wayne Chapman was investigated for every missing child in the Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New England, we'll just call it that area, in the 1970s. He was a main suspect, and I go through a list in the book of all the missing boys from late 1960s into 1977 when Wayne Chapman was finally put away. Dave, there is a disturbing amount of young boys who went missing. It was very dangerous to be a young boy in the New England area in the 1970s. It was sort of a perfect storm because parents were far less inclined to keep an eye on their kids. A lot of these kids were kids like me, project kids whose parents may not have been the most attentive. And those were the type of people that Chapman preyed upon. Those kids that he saw as weak, vulnerable, that's where he went. That's what he went after. He hung out in housing projects, local pools that were in low income areas. Wayne Chapman knew exactly where to go to get his perfect victim. So, yes, I've tied Wayne Chapman to. I stopped short of accusing him because I would never do that. But I lay out a lot of intricate facts and I let the reader decide on what they think through lots of research and, you know, simply just, you know, time periods, where Chapman was, what his predilections were, who his victim, his perfect victim was, and then, you know, sort of let you decide.
All right. So actually take me through that. Obviously there were things you found that you feel are unsettling and it kind of points in, you know, directions that makes Chapman look like he was definitely complicit in more than they're even acknowledging at this point. If he was such a dim bulb and he was easily caught and kind of owned up to what he did, why would he, do you think, not admit to some of the crimes then? Was it because there was murder, there was more horrific natures, and he understood the true danger in admitting that?
Yes, eventually Wayne was schooled. And when he left Pennsylvania, I could never corroborate and I could never get a straight answer on how Wayne Chapman from Jamestown, New York, ended up living at 129 Linwood Avenue in Providence, Rhode Island, about 20 minutes from where I sit right now. Somehow, some way, Wayne Chapman decided to live in Providence. And when he got to Providence, what he found was a bustling underground child pornography ring and in child sexual abusers, a group of men who sort of operated together and traded pornography together and even sometimes abused children together.
How do you just stumble into a ring like that? If it's so underground, it would seem like it would be really hard to get access to that, especially back then. It's not the advent of the internet where I can do it at home through cloaked servers and such, right? I mean, this would have been, you had to be out actively pursuing.
David, I'm glad you asked and I'll give you the answer. Wayne Chapman knew from his time that most men of his ilk would probably hang around public parks or schools. Chapman was incredibly mobile, as I've said. He lived in Providence, but he ended up stalking a lot in Western Massachusetts, in Worcester, Webster, Mass., Lawrence, Massachusetts, all towns that are north of Boston. And one day he was sitting on a park bench taking pictures of some children. And he struck up a friendship with a man who would become a pretty famous child killer himself, a man who at that time was named David Brown, but the world knows him as Nathaniel Bar-Jonah. Bar-Jonah was a psychopath, a sadistic pedophile who was known in the area of Webster, Massachusetts for abducting young boys and even once a young girl that he mistook for a young boy. And he beat this girl so bad that she ended up defecating all over his car. Throwing up, she nearly choked to death on her own throw up, on her own vomit. David Brown was the most one of the more sadistic pedophiles that I've ever studied. And the scary part of it all is that he considered Wayne Chapman to be his best friend. Those two operated together, and without law enforcement knowing, for at least 2 years. Eventually, Nathaniel Bar-Jonah was arrested, civilly committed for the rape of two boys, and he was essentially thrown out of Massachusetts. They told him, listen, you got to go. We don't want you in the community anymore. And he moved to Great Falls, Montana with his mother. And wouldn't you know it, Dave, not even 3 years into his time living in Montana, a 10-year-old boy goes missing, a boy named Zachary Ramsey. Zach Ramsey, body was never found. Nathaniel Bar-Jonah was a note taker. He kept a journal. And I know we're kind of jumping around here, but the bottom line is not only did they find codes in Nathaniel Bar-Jonah's journal about consuming the flesh of Zachary Ramsey, they found notes in his journal about Andy Puglisi and the murder of Andy Puglisi. They found human bones that they could never identify in Bar-Jonah's garage. And Wayne Chapman and Bar-Jonah had operated, like I said, together for at least 2 years in Massachusetts. They were locked up in prison together for many years. And that's when Wayne Chapman, to get back to your point, started to get smart as a criminal. He was schooled by Bar-Jonah and others. A man named Charles Pierce was also in their group. Pierce was a carnival worker from Chicago, who was a notorious child killer. When asked by the Massachusetts State Police how many kids he think he killed, he simply could not state a number. He just said, there's just so many, I don't know where to start. He might be the most notorious and body count wise, the most prolific child murderer in American history. And Nathaniel Bar-Jonah, Wayne Chapman, and Charlie Pierce sort of formed an unholy union there in the early 1970s in New England. And that's really where, when I started uncovering that, is when the book sort of went on overdrive, because just to think of those three together, you know, nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah. It's truly like Freddy, Jason, and Michael Myers all hanging out right at your corner stop. I'm curious with these stories populating, especially three guys in one area, you know, kind of doing this. And you said at one point there were five known pedophiles. How, maybe, again, I'm too, my brain is infiltrated by Hollywood too much and revenge movies, but I know being a father, the last thing you're going to do in this world is hurt one of my kids, period. And if I know that my kid wasn't the first, or found out that it happened another one after my kid, I don't know that you would have been able to stop me from ending that man's life. How does this guy just, or any of them, continue to live in the same general areas for so long and nobody just takes them out? You know, maybe accidentally hits them because their car locks up or something. Yeah, there has to be a way.
It's true. I mean, I have often fantasized, and I've actually written about it in the book, of how I wish I could have. Sometimes in my dreams, I would stop Wayne Chapman from doing something and do the world a favor, you know, although I don't advocate for violence. You know, it's a great question. These guys were able to operate completely under the radar, Dave, and police had gotten onto them. A recurring character in the book is a man named Albert Mintz. Albert Mintz is a sex crimes detective, or was, with the Providence Police Department from 1968 to 78. Al Mintz is the hero of this book because he was on to Chapman and his ilk very quickly. Al Mintz would dig through his trash. Al Mintz would find his receipts of where he was. He would do detective work outside of his regular job because his bosses were telling him, get off of Wayne Chapman. He's a weirdo, but we're not focused on Wayne Chapman. We're focused on corruption in the city of Providence. We're focused on theft. And just to get the timeline straight, you know, at the point he moved to Providence and started meeting with Barjona and Pierce, families were starting to get letters in the mail, poorly worded, terrible English, sometimes words cut out of magazines, old school, about a 4-H club that had been formed in Providence. And of course, being the 1970s, parents being trusting, kids were getting sent to this 4-H club. This 4-H club didn't exist. This 4-H club was ran by Wayne Chapman on the third floor of 129 Linwood Avenue.
Oh, Jesus.
It's been estimated in, you know, from talking to all the sources that I could in Providence, just being so close to the neighborhood, that Chapman molested 60 plus boys just from this 4-H club alone. Again, Dave, a lot of these boys, and one in particular, went on to be a serial molester himself. It's just the damage that Wayne Chapman did to the community of Providence, Rhode Island, will be known for generations. Some of these guys went on to offend and hurt other little boys themselves. Chapman was so prolific there in the short time that he spent that the shockwaves of him being there are going to be felt for a very, very long time.
Right. We often forget that the true victimization doesn't end at the end of that. You know, that reign of terror has ties that will be etched deep into the community for a long, long, long time after.
Sure. And you know, of course, you know, these guys are not all that old. You know, that was just the mid-1970s. You know, they're in their 50s. They're still alive. They're still all out there, you know, close here. And, you know, I just don't think we'll ever get the full breath. You know, they're just to tie some other characters into it. There was a man who became close personal friends with Nathaniel Barjona in Montana. His name was Doc Bowman, a man named Kevin Weikert. I call him Doc in the book. He was one of the founding members of NAMBLA, the North American Man-Boy Love Association, which sadly enough started in my hometown of Boston, Massachusetts. This guy had six decades worth of police records of offending against children. Wouldn't you know it, Dave? As soon as I could track him from Massachusetts, in the same time frame of Wayne Chapman and Nathaniel Barjona, as soon as I lost track of him, he sprouted up in Montana, not just a mile away from where Nathaniel Barjona lived. Keith Donaldson, another well-known pedophile from the time frame in Massachusetts, disappears off the radar in Massachusetts, and he's a mile and a half away from Nathaniel Barjona in Montana. It just goes on and on of the amount of men who are tied to them who all of a sudden migrate to Montana. And a common theme in the book is that these men know they're the pariahs of society, and sharks swim together. And very often, unfortunately, these people work together. They fund each other. When Wayne Chapman was eventually caught, he was caught with $9,000 worth of camera equipment. The man worked as a janitor. I mean, he was funded quite well. They pool their money together. And the full breadth of just what was happening, and this drives me crazy, but I just don't think it'll ever be known, Dave.
God, that's terrifying. That's so scary to me to know that there is this dark underbelly. And obviously, I'm not blind to it. And after having done, 10, 12 years of true crime stories, right, I understand that there's bad people out there. I'm just sickened how easy it is for them to find and come together, and just how dark this thing is. I was just speaking to friends of mine that are part of the LGBTQ community. Yes. And they said that even the NAMBLA keeps trying to is trying to get in there, saying this is a sexual choice and this is blah blah blah, and that whole community's like, oh fuck, no, totally different thing.
I think my next book, Dave, not to cut you off, is going to be a book on NAMBLA, because I can tie the formation of NAMBLA directly to the men like Wayne Chapman and Barjona who operated in the 1970s in Massachusetts. That was sort of the unofficial beginning of NAMBLA right there.
Is that something you really want to do? God, if this one made you feel icky, can you imagine how much worse you're going to feel going forward and digging out this new aspect of the story?
Dave, I think nowadays with what I see going on in schools with the sexualization of children and how it's trying, for some reason, some dark force is trying to make that normal. As a victim of it myself and knowing how that feels on a day-to-day basis, I just, somebody's got to do that. Somebody's got to write about that. Somebody's got to expose that. So, I'm no hero BS here at all. It's just, there's so much to be told about NAMBLA too, that I don't think people know. And why don't they know it? The whole reason why I wrote this Wayne Chapman book, Dave, more than anything, is because I see documentary after documentary about Barjona. A lot of people have gotten rich off his case, and I've seen them, and nothing is ever mentioned about what he was doing with other people in concert. It's not told. And stories that are not told are what really interest me. They're lost to time. They're lost to history. Right. And I want to continue to push those out to the forefront again.
And it's important to do that because you're not doing it to glorify the criminal, but it's to make sure that the victims aren't forgotten and the true story, the people that are left behind, are recognized, and I understand that's got to be a double-edged sword too, right? There's got to be an angle where it's like, hey, I don't want people to know that I was that kid. I was one of those people. That's got to be a terrifying aspect as well.
Yes. In fact, Dave, 2 years ago, I nearly shelved the book because I have talked to scores of victims of Wayne Chapman. And one victim said to me, and I'll never forget this. He said to me, Dave, I respect you and I think you're a great human being. And I know you have the best of intentions, but I don't want to walk into a Barnes & Noble one day and see this effing guy's face on a book. And that really struck me. And I said, you know what? He's right. I can't do this because it is a major embarrassment and an open wound in this area that this man operated. And eventually just talking to other victims, I think I have some credibility because I was that kid too. I was that weak kid who got victimized, So at the end of the day, I don't want it to if we can get people to talk about it again and get it back into the public's, you know, sort of thought, then it's done its job. You know, it's not for money. Nobody makes money on books. Every single penny that anybody spends on this book is going to go right to, you know, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children or to Puglisi's family. Or, you know, I'm not looking to make a penny and I won't take a penny. It's not about that. You know, it's about recognizing the next Wayne Chapman in your neighborhood, because they melt into the community. They don't wear hats that say, you know,
watch out. Yeah, right.
They don't. The only people who know who these people are their victims. That's it.
Jeez. What a heartbreak. Just it's so disturbing. Now, you said you actually got to meet with Chapman.
Yes. So
walk us through that experience.
The Puglisi thing happens in 1976. So just to give some sort of context to it, Wayne Chapman is present that day at the pool. There were five other sex offenders there. I believe I have narrowed it down to Chapman was with Barjona, Charles Pierce, a man named Eugene Weir, who will come up later in the story. I know we don't have a ton of time, but I'll get there. And probably that man, Doc Bowman, that I mentioned. So there are five of them are there together. I don't believe that they tried to kill Andy. I believe that they tried to rape him. They succeeded in doing so, horrifyingly enough. And Andy had some medical issues. And I believe that, unfortunately, things got out of hand and Andy was killed. Wayne Chapman then takes the body and puts it in the back of his 1965 Dodge van. Hightails it out of there. National search, national news store gets picked up. Green Berets from the 11th Special Forces Group at Fort Devens locally come out to search. I mean, it is an exhaustive search. It's the biggest story in the country for that day, August 10th, 1976. Chapman at that time worked at Miriam Hospital in Providence, Rhode Island. He was a sanitation engineer, aka janitor. Wayne Chapman has a key to the incinerator. He's supposed to be off work the next day. Chapman comes into work the next day, which I have been able to verify through payroll records. There is an unauthorized burn in the incinerator the very next day. I believe Andy Puglisi's body was put there. And unfortunately for the Puglisi family, he is burned right there in that incinerator. Chapman keeps a sock, a bloody sock of Andy Puglisi's. He is picked up 2 days later on a routine traffic stop in Waterloo, New York. The police officer, Sergeant Tony Vatter of the New York State Police, finds a pistol, a bloody sock, and 150 pictures spread out over the dashboard of children, some nude, some in suggestive poses, and some just playing on playgrounds and schoolyards. Wayne Chapman could not take a drive without having pictures of children in front of him. Eventually, Chapman is brought in, and he is interrogated. He admits to killing Puglisi and then recants the admission. He's eventually charged with two other rapes the summer prior in Lawrence at the same exact pool where Puglisi goes missing. In Massachusetts, we have civil commitments. Even if you owe no time to the government for your crimes, they can civilly commit you to life if you are deemed such a threat to the community sexually. Wayne Chapman is committed for life at that time, 1977. He ends up in Bridgewater, which is the Massachusetts Treatment Center for the Sexually Dangerous, just about 20 minutes from here, Bridgewater State Hospital. Chapman is behind walls with, again, Nathaniel Barjona, Charles Pierce, guys like that, again, end up in the prison with him for their own sex crimes. Charlie Pierce had pled guilty by that point to the murder of a little girl named Janice Pocket in Tallinn, Connecticut. They're able to commiserate behind bars about how if they ever do get out of there, they'll do things differently. At that time, Chapman takes up sort of the Christianity. You know, he becomes a good, inmate. He meets some psychologists that are, you know, frankly, they're just sympathetic to his cause of Christianity. And he often opined, and I got this right from staff members who talked to me, and I've talked to many staff members over the years who worked with Chapman, that he was set up in the Puglisi thing. He would regularly bring up Andy Puglisi's name just in groups, and a lot of it in detail in the book. I'm trying to give you the condensed version, of course. Even though that bloody sock that was found in his van during that traffic stop, Andy Puglisi's mother was able to positively identify that of Andy. So that even though DNA didn't exist at the time, his mother was able to identify the sock as Andy's, and he was still never charged with the murder. They never found the body. And that was one thing that Charles Pierce always told him, make sure that you never, ever, the police never find that body. No body, no crime, which is, you know, Barjona also took that to heart. That's why he ate his victims, to make sure that there would be no body.
And I tie
that all in the book. All of these sort of reason why you don't find bodies and just bones is because Charlie Pierce schooled these guys on how to get away with these crimes. And obviously I go into it in much more detail than we can here. But Chapman stays behind the walls of the prison all through the 1980s, the 1990s. And in 2017, I'm home from class one night, just walked in the door, and I see a news report that Wayne Chapman is going to be released from his civil commitment, and he's going to be sent to a homeless shelter in the Boston area. Now, I know from growing up in that area exactly what homeless shelter he'll probably be at. I know that they get released at a certain time in the morning. They're not allowed to hang out, so they're basically kicked out, and then they have to come back in the afternoon. I had seen an interview with James Renner, the great true crime author. He had a favorite suspect in the case of a case that he was obsessed with, of a little girl named Amy Mihalovich. And he actually tracked down his suspect and talked about how he was going to call his bluff and basically, you know, say that I have evidence that I know the police haven't brought up to you. And he was going to call his bluff and basically tell him a lie and just say, hey, and see what his reaction would be. And, you know, I told myself if I ever came close to Chapman that I would do that. Now, David, you know, I've been all over this world. I've been in front of Taliban terrorists, Boko Haram, Haqqani Network, who kill young girls for simply just trying to read or wearing Western type outfits. I've been all over this world and been in front of some really bad people. But I cannot explain to you the feeling I got when I finally got in front of Wayne Chapman on the street in the middle of a winter day in Boston in his wheelchair. I mean, his eyes were just vacant, just nothing there. And I said to him, I leaned into him and I said, I know that there was an unauthorized burn the next day. I know you were the only person who had that key. And I said to him, which was a lie, but I wanted to see how he'd react. I said, I know that they found DNA in that incinerator. And I was like, I effing know that you killed Puglisi. And I said, I'm going to write about it. And he looked right at me and he just said, you know, I've never been to Lawrence, even though he had committed two rapes there that he admitted to doing and got a civil commitment for the rest of his life for it. He just denied it completely to me and said, I've never even been there. And then he just kind of looked the other way. And I had some few choice words for him, but I didn't want to lose my temper, Dave, because, you know, it's not worth going to, you know, spending 5 minutes in jail for a guy who's going to burn in hell anyway, you know? And
right.
His reaction was just, there was nothing there. He had no emotion. I presented him with evidence that I told him I knew, and there was nothing there. He doesn't have the ability to care, Dave. He doesn't care, and he'll never care. And he's alive right now. He lives in a nursing home in Connecticut, where his window overlooks a school. And every single day of Wayne Chapman's life, he's offending in his own mind. And if he was mobile, he'd be offending out in broad daylight in the middle of the street, because guys like Wayne Chapman, unless they're buried under a jail or 6 feet underground, they'll never stop, ever.
Was it cathartic for you to face him and speak, or did it fall empty for you that you felt like, boy, if I ever got this chance, and once you did, it didn't live up to that hyped concept?
You know, I would love to create a story, you know, that was like, you know, some sort of like gotcha moment with Chapman, but he had been lying for 30 years about the Puglisi case. It was just his reflex to deny, 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 which again, he was schooled by a renowned reviled child killer and Charlie Pierce on what to say if somebody presents you with evidence. He didn't try to deny it. He knows for a fact that he had the key to the incinerator. He knows full well that he put the body in there and there was an unauthorized burn. I've seen all the documents. He knows that I know. And I thought that being presented with the fact that I know would move him in some way, but it was just a vacant stare and a flat denial and the flattest voice you could get. It really did fall flat, Dave. But was it cathartic? Sure. I just wish that, I could have gotten more. I don't know what I was expecting, though. What you know what I mean? In retrospect, right. What could I have expected? You know,
I'm sure there's always that aspect of I'm just hoping that he's going to break down and say, I did it. I'm sorry. I did it. So that you get that closure. You get that sense of feel. I understand it, man. You know, we want that.
We just had a case because, again, David, this is. Boston is the Catholic priest scandal. This was the center of it with the child abuse. We had a young boy killed in 1972, a young boy named Danny Crotu. And he was killed by a pedophile priest. And that priest on his deathbed just last year admitted to the rape and murder of a 12-year-old boy named Danny Crotu in Springfield, Massachusetts. That happens. And we're seeing more and more of that now. At least locally. And I'm still hoping that Wayne Chapman has enough guts in his body, which I sincerely doubt, to at least give the Puglisi family some closure. Because you know what, David? Every year on the anniversary, it just happened in August, there's a news story about they're digging up somewhere or they're digging up some park where Chapman might have, been at some point. And in my opinion, it's just all for naught. They're never going to find him because he died right there in that incinerator in Providence.
God, that's tragic. Well, the book, again, we have a link for it on our site. You'll be able to find it on the show program guide. David, thanks for digging into this to keep this story out there because these people shouldn't be forgotten and the victims shouldn't be forgotten. And maybe this will not inspire him to come forward, but maybe somebody else that knows something may have that tinge of humanity left in them that will make them come forward now. And that's all we can hope for.
It's so true, Dave. Just in closing, I've done 7 years of research or whatever it was, and I still know that I don't know everything. To this day, once a week, somebody will send me an email or this story never ends. I wrote 300 pages, 50,000 words on this story. And if somebody out there knows anything or lived in the time period or absolutely anything, I am more than willing and I will get right back to you on it. Please, please reach out to me.
Yeah. How can they reach out to you? What's the best way, David?
I'm on Twitter at my name, David McGrath, 11B. Or just shoot me an email, my name, davidmcgrath11b@gmail.com. A lot of the tips for this book honestly came through emails and then me kind of just digging into it and corroborating it. If you know anything, remember anything from Montana to Virginia to any state that you're living in, that you're listening to this right now, please reach out to me. I will never stop on this story. I'll be 65 years old in a nursing home, still trying to figure out what the hell happened here. So.
All right, David McGrath, thank you so much. Thank you all for tuning in and checking out the interview. For those of you that are full premium Stitcher subscribers, stay tuned because we've got Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals coming up next. For those of you that are our standard subscribers, thank you for tuning in to the best in true crime talk radio. We'll be back again next week with more True Crime Tuesday.